This is part of a much bigger project that I'm working on. But some of the themes of that bigger project are very much evident in this particular paper. I'll just highlight those. The first theme is obviously the fact that there are important continuities. Often partition is seen as a discontinuity, and yet there are important continuities in terms of economics, politics, British social life. Many Britons stayed on in Pakistan and in India after a partition. And looking at it in diplomatic terms, which is what this particular paper does, it's just part of these continuities that we will see as we look at what is often now termed, after Wazir Zamindar's work, the long partition. The chronological frame for this, obviously starting in 1947, is quite logical. Why 1965? Well, obviously 1965 is an important moment both in the diplomatic relations of Pakistan after the war with India. It's also an important moment for Britain, as really 1965 is the last moment in diplomatic terms where Britain is able to play a key mediatory role in Pakistan. So it's a cut-off point. The other cut-off point of 1965 is also the fact that by that stage the move had been made of all of the embassies, and in the British case high commissions, from Karachi to Rawalpindi, because Ayub Khan, Pakistan's first military ruler, had decreed the new capital should be built, which of course was constructed in Islamabad. But he moved many of the ministries up to Rawalpindi from 1959 onwards, which left international diplomats in a difficult position, because they then had to trek 1,800 miles back and forth from Karachi up to Rawalpindi, because of course Islamabad itself was a building site, and indeed it was only in 1971 that the current British High Commission building was opened in Islamabad. So it's an important sort of formative era, this period from 1947 to 65, both in terms of Pakistan's internal politics and relations with India, but it's also an important era in terms of diplomatic representation, and it illustrates some of these continuities which I want to talk about in the more general work that I'm doing. So that's the first starting point. The second thing I want to say is that we're looking really at four British High Commissioners in this period of time, namely Sir Lawrence Graffity Smith, who was High Commissioner from 1947 to 51, Sir Gilbert Lathwaite, who was High Commissioner from 1951 to 4, Sir Alexander Simon, who was High Commissioner from 1954 to 61, and then the last one, Sir Maurice James, 1961 to 5. What we'll see as we go through this presentation is that these were all very different men with very different personalities, very different interests, and different experiences. And that influenced the way in which they followed their instructions, which were sent from London, in terms of what they should do and what their priorities were. However, of course, despite all these different personalities, there were constants. And Kashmir, as you would well imagine, is a constant throughout this period of time. Britain was in a particularly difficult position over this dispute, because of course it involved two dominions, members of the Commonwealth, and also it created the conditions, certainly in 1947-8, where British troops, or British officers I should say, were involved both in the Indian Army and the Pakistan Army, and could come into conflict with each other. So it was the need to balance India and Pakistani interest over Kashmir was a constant problem for the High Commission. And it could be argued that it was a factor in Britain's gradually diminishing influence. So having said that, Britain's influence would have diminished anyway in this period, given that it didn't have the military or the economic resources to help develop Pakistan in the way that the United States, certainly from 1954 onwards, was able to do so. But nonetheless, this tricky balancing act, not wanting to upset either New Delhi or Karachi Rawalpindi, was an issue in this diminishing influence. Though one shouldn't see this as happening all at once, and this is where the continuities come in. Britain is still quite influential in the mid-1950s in terms of Pakistan. It's only really by the end of our period, 1965, that influence is beginning to be on the way. So those are some of the themes that I want to bring out in this presentation. I'm going to start just by saying that the creation of diplomatic missions could be seen as part of, yet again, the hidden history of partition. We've had many hidden histories of partition being revealed in recent times, but this is one of them. How did overseas governments set up diplomatic missions in this new state when they really only had a matter of weeks to do it? And what also made the situation difficult for them was the fact that Karachi, which is where the capital was initially, before Ayub decreed it should be moved, was totally overcrowded with refugees, with Pakistan officials. Space was really at a premium. And Britain, of course, had an advantage over other countries in that it had connections with the incoming Pakistan authorities. In a way, it didn't have to house its diplomats, as many countries did, in hotels. The Palace Hotel in Clifton was the place where many diplomats found themselves spending months on end in 1947-8. The Americans ended up on the second floor of a commercial building over a Jeep dealer's showroom and repair shop. So you can see that there are real problems as to where physically you're going to put your mission. So this is where the British Chancery was first established, in Wood Street in Karachi. And it was an office which they actually rented from the British Chamber of Commerce. And here again, you can see this continuing influence of Britain, enabling them to have access to this building. And this building served for many years as the Chancery. There were drawbacks to it in the sense that it was not really private. And the first floor of the building was actually housing Pakistani officials. In the post and telegraph department of the government. So there's a problem there of security of material that's coming in and out of this chancery. The residency in the early years was actually, again, something which the British used their influence in the incoming Pakistan authorities with, and it was the old Sindh collector's residence, again in the Clifton area. So these are ad hoc arrangements which Britain set up, but they do show also that there were some advantages for an outgoing colonial power in terms of impact and influence with the Pakistan authorities. So there wasn't quite the same scrambling around that other powers had to have. So now I want to look initially at the first British High Commissioner, Sir Lawrence Graffiti Smith. And I just want to say a few things about his background. Lawrence Graffiti Smith is the odd man out of these four High Commissioners, in that he had no previous experience whatsoever in the Indian subcontinent. He admitted in his later autobiography, quote, "I was moving to an ambience of strange languages, unfamiliar attitudes, and new perspectives. I was conscious of a basic inadequacy of my experience. My ignorance extended even to linguistics, for I believed optimistically that Urdu was a dialect of Persian." So this is Lawrence Graffiti Smith, the first British High Commissioner. You can probably see from that quotation that most of his career up until this point had been in the Middle East. He'd worked in Mosul, Baghdad, Saudi Arabia. He was the Assistant Oriental Secretary at the Cairo Residency. And his appointment, you could say, was surprising. Why would you get someone with this background and not an Indian background to be the first High Commissioner of this new dominion of Pakistan? It may be, of course, that it indicates that Britain always viewed Pakistan as not just part of the subcontinent, but in a wider Islamic context, a wider Islamic world. And certainly that's the way Lawrence Graffiti Smith approached his job. He was very pro-Pakistan in his outlook, even to the extent that Attlee had to wrap him over the knuckles in 1950 and say he was acting in a partisan manner. Lawrence Graffiti Smith's papers, interestingly, if you want to follow this up, are in the Middle Eastern sort of center archives at St. Anthony's. And in those papers, you will see that he attaches a cover sheet to these documents in which he really produces a lament that he is sort of his views were being disregarded in London. He says, "Any recommendations made from Karachi were shipwrecked on attitudes in London. These were formed by the Attlee administration's long and historical association with Congress and by the relative importance to Great Britain of Indian or Pakistan goodwill." And he ends his cover sheet note with this dramatic assertion. "If I do Mr. Attlee and his colleagues any injustice in assessing their policies towards the rival dominions as to tending always to favour Mr. Nehru, may God forgive me." Those documents are there now at St. Anthony's because he wanted to safeguard his position in history and to try and overcome this criticism of Attlee that he was partisan. Because, of course, that's one of the worst things that any serving overseas diplomat can be accused of, to be going local, going native, and representing the views of the country rather than looking in a more balanced way. Graffiti Smith, despite his scrapes with London over Kashmir, and his position in Kashmir can be boiled down to really two points. Firstly, he believes that Pakistan was the aggrieved party, not India. That was his position. He always maintained that. And secondly, he maintained the position, which of course is still represented, or was at least down to Kargil, 1999, in Pakistani historiography, that Pakistan had no possibility of preventing this tribal invasion into Jammu and Kashmir in October 1947, which started off the whole crisis. So that was the view that Graffiti Smith had, and obviously it's very close to the view of the Pakistan authorities as far as this is concerned. How did he get on aside from his scrape with London over Kashmir, the fact he had no background? Well, the point is, of course, whilst I'm focusing on individual personalities, and it's really not a good approach in history to do that, Really, what you've got to look at is the fact that all of these high commissioners we're going to examine were supported by experienced colleagues. It's very important for Graffiti Smith that the head of the Chancery, his number two, was someone who had been serving in India for 16 years before partition and was able to advise him. This was a man by the name of Ian Scott. And Scott had been principal of Islamia College. He'd been his deputy private secretary to the Viceroy. So he's been there at the centre of power. And he, as Graffiti Smith himself acknowledges in his papers, was well placed to, quote, offer counsel of real value. So Graffiti Smith's lack of experience of the subcontinent is counterbalanced, that's the point I'm making, by these experienced colleagues. And that's the same if you look at the careers of all of the four high commissioners in the period to 65, you'll see that they rely heavily. Often their dispatches to London are verbatim the dispatches that they received from colleagues in the so-called outposts. Now, the outposts were the deputy high commissions in Dhaka, Rawalpindi, Peshawar and Lahore. And often, of course, the final report, the final dispatch the High Commissioner sends is an amalgam of these local insights. So it's important to bear that in mind. You know, this is a team effort that we're talking about here. So it doesn't all fall by the wayside if one person is inexperienced. Having said that, Graffiti Smith did try and lead and even try and get London to mediate on Pakistan's behalf over Kashmir, and that's what caused him the trouble with Attlee. So, moving on to the second of the High Commissioners, this is Sir Gilbert Lathwaite. Lathwaite is, in many ways, the exact opposite of Graffiti Smith. He is steeped in the India Office and in work in the subcontinent. He joined the India Office almost immediately after the First World War, and he was heavily involved in the 1920s and into the 1930s in constitutional reforms in India. He was the secretary to Lord Lothian's Franchise Committee, for example. Lathwaite's greatest experience before taking up the role as High Commissioner in Karachi was as private secretary to the Viceroy, Lord Linlithgow. Someone who was right at the center of power for 7 years, because Linlithgow, of course, had one of the longest tenures as Viceroy. And it was later said that Lathwaite actually was very influential behind the scenes. So Lathwaite was immensely experienced, and this meant that he didn't have to rely so much on other colleagues, and also he knew who to go to. Whereas Graffiti Smith had to be told, these are the influential people that you need to go to. Lathwaite already knew most of these people. The other thing which is interesting about Lathwaite's longer term India connection and how it influenced things was that he established very cordial relations with the British community in Pakistan. And he always went out of his way to, on his tours of the country, to stay with British factory owners, people involved in education in the country. And unlike Graffiti Smith, he was very much seeing part of his role as maintaining the morale of the British community in Pakistan. And his tour reports are full of comments regarding commercial issues. He always made it a priority to visit British-owned or British managed enterprises. He always noted approvingly if the factory machinery was British made. He was quick to spot competition. While commenting favourably, for example, that a British firm had secured a contract for constructing new jetties at Chittagong, he balanced this with the fact that West Germany had received the order for cranes, the Dutch for dredgers, and Italy for the steel construction of the new warehouses. He hoped that the British firms would take full advantages of the economic opportunities in Pakistan, because he said if they didn't, there would be a vacuum that would be swiftly filled by West Germany, Japan, France, or the United States. So here is a person who, way before the term economic diplomacy is introduced, is very much seeing that part of the role of the High Commission is to try and encourage British enterprise in Pakistan. And Lathwaite certainly, from the mid-1950s, also became concerned not just with Japanese and Western European competition for Britain, but also the emerging power of the United States in Pakistan. He was sending, you can read it in the dispatches that he sent to London, constantly along the themes that London should try and discourage Pakistan from entering into any military pact with the United States, as this would eventually diminish British influence in the country. Of course, he was whistling in the wind on this matter. Pakistan did, from 1954 onwards, enter into a military pact with the US, and of course it was an integral part of CETO and CENTO at this time. And this is, of course, when huge amounts of American aid, military aid and economic aid, begin to flow from London, from Washington into Pakistan. And Britain is just unable to compete because of its own domestic economic problems. However, Lathwaite was very aware of the fact that Britain had to try and maintain its commercial and military influence in Pakistan, and that he had this aspiration right the way down to the eve of the Suez affair, that Britain should still be a world power, and that Britain had to have a military and economic presence in countries like Pakistan in order to play that role and to sustain it. He, in some senses, left Pakistan in 1954 before American influence had totally eclipsed Britain's influence in the country. But he is a transitional figure in some senses. This interesting, quite rare photograph, as you can see, on top of the Empire State Building, New York, 1941. What does that have to do with British diplomats in Pakistan? Well, Alex Simon on the left and his wife Dodo in the middle of that picture. Alex Simon was to replace Lathwaite as the High Commissioner in Pakistan. But during the war years, Simon had actually served all his time in the United States from August 1941 onwards. There's a very interesting, but it's a digression, so I won't give you all the details of it, but account of the Simon's quite perilous journey across the Atlantic in 1941 in a convoy threatened by German U-boats to get to New York so that Simon could take up the role in New York of being the controller of the Indian supply mission in America. And he served in that role from August 1941 until the end of the war. What did he have to do in that role? Well, very briefly, he had to purchase everything from hair nets for Sikh soldiers fighting in the Indian Army through to steel, munitions, anything really for the Indian Army and its war effort. That was his role. And he traveled extensively over the States during this time and set up offices in New York and in San Francisco. He was also based for a while in Washington as well. Now, this exposure to life in America in the war years actually had an important impact on the way Simon viewed America's competition in Pakistan when he became High Commissioner. He had a sort of old-style imperialist sort of difficult relationship with the Americans, partly because of some of the resentments and some of the problems that he encountered during his service in America during the war. And he, unlike Lathwaite, tended to play down the American threat to Britain's interests in Pakistan. Indeed, one of his first dispatches, he talks in very disparaging terms of the Americans' failure to understand Pakistan and Pakistanis, whereas Britain had a natural sort of sympathy for Pakistan and Pakistanis and understood them in a way that the Americans never could. And he maintains this sort of outlook throughout the time that he is in post as High Commissioner. The other point to bear in mind of his sort of backstory before becoming High Commissioner, apart from this American experience, is that he actually had been Deputy High Commissioner in New Delhi. Just before partition, he was appointed in April 1947, and he continued to serve until the end of 1948 in India. And from mid-January 1948, when Sir Terence Schoen, who was the British High Commissioner in New Delhi, went home on extended leave, Simon was acting High Commissioner in India. He was there, he was one of the first on the scene actually when Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated, because Gandhi was living at Birla House, which was just opposite where Simon was living. So he was right on the spot there. He was also, a few weeks later, he took the salute when the 1st Battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry, the last British troops to depart from India, left. So Simon had experience in Delhi as well as experience in India before he in America before he goes to Karachi. And this is an interesting point because the British, unlike the Americans, and this I think has ramifications in how there's often a tussle going on between the American embassy in New Delhi and the American embassy in Karachi. But the British tended to cross-post people. So you might serve as Deputy High Commissioner in one country and then go as High Commissioner to the other one. That was a deliberate policy that the British adopted. And it's certainly very influential as far as the last of the four High Commissioners we're going to look at later, in terms of how he was able to approach things. The fact that he had a whole set of contacts in New Delhi, as well as contacts, obviously, in Pakistan. There's two areas which I think are of interest. One very topical after yesterday, and that is the Queen's royal visit to Pakistan in 1961. And how Simon reported on that. But before looking at that, I want to talk about his attitude to the collapse of democracy. Because, of course, his period of time in Pakistan coincides with the first military coup in October 1958, setting Pakistan on a path of military intervention, which of course has continued down to the present day. So how does Simon react, and what kind of messages did he send to London during this crucial period of time? If you look at his dispatches, what you'll see is he is very negative towards the democratic parties, and actually takes on board the criticisms of Pakistan democracy by bureaucrats and by the Pakistan army. And indeed, in some senses, more or less just repeats their criticisms of the failure of democracy as a justification for military rule. And as historians today know, that the military had their own agenda in Pakistan, and their own narrative, which may not be impartial. But Simon took at face value almost the criticisms of democracy in Pakistan. I'll just read you out, there are numerous dispatches. I'll just read you out one dispatch that he sent. This was a note in December 1957. So this is nearly a year before the coup. Quote, "There is among many people a sense of frustration and disappointment at what is said to be Pakistan's lack of progress in the past 10 years. Prices are rising, development projects are slow to mature, any real improvement in living standards seems further away than ever. In the meantime, politicians come and go and line their pockets. These frustrations lead in some sections of the populace, and particularly amongst the intelligentsia," though he doesn't, as a good student would do, reference this, "and particularly amongst the intelligentsia, to a willingness at least to toy with the prospects of putting up with a ruthless, perhaps militaristic administration, as long as it were reasonably clean and efficient." So what Simon is saying there is basically what the Pakistan army's justification for intervention in October 1958 was, that political corruption was a major problem, and that the country was chaotic, and that the army alone could bring stability. This is the story that Simon is telling. Where did he get it from? Well, he had incredibly close relationship with President Mirza, Iskander Mirza, bureaucrat turned president, anti-democrat, the person who, along with the army, planned the first coup. I say he had an incredibly close relationship with Mirza. I must say I was surprised looking at the documentary record, because in late December 1957, about the time that he's sending this report, Mirza showed him a copy of the notes of a typically fractious cabinet meeting in order to justify his criticisms of the politicians. Simon said, "I then asked whether I could have a copy of this cabinet record." Mirza, to my astonishment, said, "Yes, take a copy." So you can see here, you know, where some of his sort of ideas are coming from in terms of his criticism of the failings of Pakistan democracy. And he relays this, of course, to London. I'm not saying that his view alone would have been decisive in the British attitude to the coup, but nonetheless, he was very influential in creating this sense that this was sort of necessary, a necessary evil perhaps, but it was necessary because of chaos in the country. And of course, Simon continues after the coup to have the same positive attitude to virtually everything that the army does. So within a fortnight of the coup, Mirza is himself dismissed, and General Ayub Khan becomes the first martial law ruler of the country. How does Simon react to this situation in October 1958? Well, he says that, broadly, I accept what Ayub says about the need for getting rid of Mirza. It's generally accepted that Mirza was losing popularity. How he could lose it in a fortnight is a difficult issue. But Mirza was losing popularity because his political manoeuvring. So in other words, again, at a crucial moment of time, Simon is more or less repeating what the military is saying. There are numerous other dispatches from the period down to 1961, when he left, that you could cite. I'll just mention one of them, and this is the system of basic democracy, which was introduced in 1959. This was a sort of so-called bottom-up system of democracy, more suited to the genius of the Pakistan people, according to Ayub Khan, because they weren't suited to a full representative democracy. But basically what it did was it created 80,000 people who could be patronized by the regime and who could vote for Ayub in a presidential election and could form a sort of national sort of legislative. Historians have been very critical of the basic democracy scheme. What does Simon say about it? Well, this is a dispatch he sent in late December 1959. For the present, I suggest we should regard the introduction of basic democracies as a praiseworthy attempt to see if democracy can be got to work at all in this country. The title is not a bad one. The fundamental idea of the scheme is that in a country like this, if shoemakers or villagers are asked to choose a man to debate national interests, they make a mess of it. But they are perfectly capable of choosing a fairly competent villager or shoemaker whom they can trust to speak for them, or matters at or near their level. He concluded in this dispatch, if democracy can work here, this is the way it should be able to work from the village upwards. No one has suggested anything better. If it cannot work even in this way, then, says President Ayub, God help us. So he's repeating again Ayub's sort of attitudes to London about democracy. Moving on very quickly, the final act of Simon's period as High Commissioner was the visit in February 1961 of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh. They embarked on a 15-day tour of Pakistan. And the royal visit, of course, was to symbolize the close ties between the two countries. Simon accompanied them on the tour, which included visits to Peshawar, the Khyber Pass, Swat, Lahore, Dhaka, and Chittagong. And again, in the Simon papers, you will see detailed what he called letters from the field, which are basically his accounts of their visit. And there are two things really which he stresses, but you could say that he was looking for compliments in this, in that he had played a large role in setting up the itinerary and the arrangements, along, of course, with the palace's protocol and the protocol of the Pakistan Foreign Ministry. But nonetheless, he was taking the plaudits for what he claimed was an incredibly successful tour. He estimates large crowds, 30,000 in the immediate vicinity of Peshawar. He counted 115 triumphal arches along the 32-mile route between Peshawar and Mardan. And he wrote back to London, "The more this tour progresses, the more I am struck by the genuine spontaneity of the reaction of the Pakistani crowds to Her Majesty's appearance. Continuous wave of hand clapping and zindabads accompanies the royal car. Her Majesty is always punctilious in ordering the driver to slow down wherever there are crowds of people, however small or isolated the village." It's just sort of out of shot here. This is obviously the Lahore part of the visit, which came towards the end, I think on the 11th of February 1961. Simon says that an estimated crowd of 200,000 greeted the Queen when she visited the horse and cattle show in Lahore. What do we make of all of this? Well, I think the first thing is that it's interesting if you read Simon's accounts of the royal tour with the American ambassador's account of the First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, visit shortly afterwards to Pakistan. And you will see great differences in the way in which these trips are recorded. Simon's reporting, I don't know whether he intended it or whether it was just part of his makeup, but what comes across from his reporting is this was a last hurrah for the Raj, despite the royal couple's youthfulness. Whereas the accounts of Jackie Kennedy's visits to Pakistan, the emphasis there is very much on looking forward, modernity. One of the points the ambassador made was about the First Lady's visits was particularly popular with young women, which showed the rising status of women of the educated classes in Pakistan. This is not the kind of thing that Simon would have thought of. So Simon retires to England early in 1961, and Sir Maurice James is our last High Commissioner of this period. James had also, like Simon, served as Deputy High Commissioner in India before taking up the role in Pakistan. So it's part of this crossover of appointments which the British really engage in. Also, James, earlier in his career, had served as Deputy High Commissioner in Pakistan as well. So he'd been both Deputy High Commissioner in India and in Pakistan before becoming High Commissioner in Pakistan. Former Balliol man, for those who are into local linkages, and Marine. You can probably see he's quite a burly figure. Very different to both Lathwaite and to Simon. In some senses, a much more modern High Commissioner than Lathwaite and Simon. Simon particularly being a bit of a throwback to the Raj era, both the way he conducted himself, his style of dress, how he ran the High Commission. We don't have time to look at that now. But James is a much younger figure. noted for his energy and stamina, and also for his astute judgment of leading personalities. Back in 1965, for example, he pens a note about Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who was then, of course, the foreign minister of Pakistan. Later, of course, to be president and prime minister, and he almost prophetically says that here was a man who was likely to be hung because of his high-handedness, his charisma, but also his ability to make enemies. So, Maurice James is involved in intense diplomacy in 1962-3, and again in 1965. This is the time when the High Commission really is at its peak in terms of its diplomatic as opposed to its other activities, whether it's overseeing royal tours, sending political dispatches, or looking for commercial opportunities for Britain. This is the old style diplomacy we're talking about now. 1962-3, there was intense Anglo-American diplomacy to try and get a resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The reason for this, why does it suddenly appear on the radar now? It's been off the radar for a few years, is of course it's the consequence of the Sino-Indian War in 1962. And that war raises the threat of People's Republic of China becoming a major player in South Asia, and which is likely to exploit Pakistan-Indian rivalry. So you can see why there's a sudden urge in 1962-3 to try and secure a resolution. There were six rounds of talks. This gives you an indication of how much emphasis was being placed on this. They wouldn't have gone to six rounds, actually, if it wasn't for the joint arm twisting that Maurice James and his American counterpart had with Bhutto to try and get Bhutto to continue these talks. Bhutto, even at this stage of his career, was not prepared to give an inch to India. Washington and London tried out various possibilities. Partition, internationalization was another suggestion. An international mediator, President Eisenhower, was actually suggested, ex-President Eisenhower, of course, by this stage, as a mediator. These talks eventually failed, but not without revealing, I think, if you look in the documentation, two very important things. Firstly, the degree of coordination of effort between Washington and London. Huge coordination of effort. Indeed, they took it in turns, good cop, bad cop. They took it in turns to try and get either the Pakistanis or the Indians to agree to what they hoped for. It also reveals, of course, the limits of Western influence, which I think followers of conspiracy theories, particularly relating to Pakistan, who see virtually everything happening in Pakistan as a result of American Western influence. This is a salutary lesson that despite this intense diplomatic activity, the bottom line was neither India nor Pakistan would budge as far as Kashmir was concerned. So it shows you that. The other element, I think, which is important, again coming out of the dispatches, is not only was James interacting with the American embassy in great depth, but also he was interacting with his old boss in New Delhi, poor Gore Booth, who was the High Commissioner, British High Commissioner in New Delhi. And they interacted very closely and again tried to pull their influence to get a resolution, but all to no avail. We won't go into all the details of the fallout of the failure of this, but I think you can see how the continuation of Western military support for India after its defeat at the hands of China creates a sense of time running out in Pakistan if they want to use military might to resolve Kashmir. That's the first, I think, legacy of this long drama of talks. There's also, I think, a sense, certainly, that this is the moment, really, 62-63, when Bhutto begins to have an influence on Ayub Khan. Ayub Khan, up until this point, had been very pro-Western, and he is increasingly influenced by Bhutto, one towards China, after the war particularly, but also he's encouraged by Bhutto. I'm not saying Bhutto's the only figure, but he's encouraged by Bhutto to contemplate a military solution to the Kashmir war dispute. And all of this, of course, culminates in the 1965 war. But of course, the later conflict in Kashmir and then spills over into the Punjab is predated by the conflict in the Iran of Kutch 4 months earlier. And in this conflict, I won't go into the full details of why there was a conflict in that particular area, but what is important to bear in mind is, again, you see evidence of British mediation and James using his influence over both Pakistan and India to try and secure mediation. James brought home the seriousness of the situation to Bhutto by quoting reports on Indian opinion that he'd received from the British High Commission in Delhi. With the permission of the Commonwealth Office, James then flew on a solo diplomatic mission to New Delhi on the 30th of April to try and utilize his contacts in both capitals to reduce tensions. The British government made a formal offer of mediation, which was accepted by both sides. And whilst this was conducted in the name of the Prime Minister Harold Wilson, in practice, it was really Freeman, the High Commissioner who replaced Booth in New Delhi, and Maurice James, who were influential in this mediation. You can see evidence of this. Harold Wilson sent a letter personally thanking Maurice James for his, quote, very great contribution to the success of the mediation. So this, I think, is the high point of the High Commission in terms of its ability to act in a traditional diplomatic format in the subcontinent. What is interesting is that in the second round of the conflict, the one prompted by Pakistanis launching Operation Gibraltar in Kashmir, in the second round, Britain is not the key mediating figure at the end, but it's the Soviet Union. It's the Soviet Union which brokers the Tashkent peace at the end of that particular conflict. Having said that, James did play a role in that he repeatedly met with Ayyub during the course of this two-week conflict. He candidly warned Ayyub of the danger of a major escalation, particularly if China becomes involved. And he also tried to emphasize the need for UN ceasefire resolution to be accepted by the Pakistanis. Of course, they didn't just accept a ceasefire because James told them. They were running out of ammunition and saw that it was impossible to continue fighting. But nonetheless, James again is playing a role. But in the subsequent diplomatic maneuverings at Tashkent, Britain and the United States, for that matter, are not in this. So I just want to conclude then. So what can we gain from looking at this period, 1947 to 65? And I'd like to leave you really with three points to think about. The first thing is the continuities of influence of Britain. It's true, it's waning by 1965, but it's still there. It doesn't just cease in this part of the world with partition. I think the second point, which is important to bear in mind, is that both Britain and the United States had also limits of influence. They couldn't prevent military conflict. They couldn't force a resolution of the Kashmir dispute, despite intense diplomatic activities. So there are limits as well as an extent of influence. And this is, of course, particularly galling for the Americans, who have put huge resources into Pakistan, certainly from the mid-1950s onwards. And by 1965, they're totally disillusioned. If you look at reports from Washington, you'll see that they see nothing coming out of this relationship. And this, of course, is carried on down almost to the current day, you know, in terms of this checkered relationship and America thinking it's going to get much more out of military aid to Pakistan than it can actually get. And I think the third thing is that this is a formative period, not just, of course, for Pakistan politics with the martial law coming in 1958. It's also a formative period for Britain in Pakistan, with the beginnings of an economic declining influence, a declining population accompanying that. And also, of course, Britain has to adjust itself to the changed environment as a result of the emergence of the Soviet Union and of China as players. So while Simon might be quite happy in lauding the Queen's visit, and of seeing this as a symbol of great British influence in Pakistan, in many ways, British influence is on the way. I'll leave it at that point. Thank you.